You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
If I have to take one thing from this movie, it's really the power of fear, right? How if you can make people fear something, you have them in the palm of your hand, and especially fear of the other, fear of the foreign, fear of, you know, black people, Mexican people, you name it. And, you know, it's the United States is not the only country where this has happened. If you look at drug laws in Brazil, the first drug laws in Brazil started in 1830 and were associated in Rio de Janeiro to former slaves who were organizing as street gangs because they couldn't make much more money, and who were practicing capoeira and smoking marijuana. When slavery was abolished in 1888, and there was a massive rural exodus towards those same urban areas, former slaves coming in, consuming marijuana, and, you know, increasing the stigma against dark and minority populations. In South Africa, the same pattern that followed the establishment of apartheid served to establish the first drug laws, essentially protection of whiteness. And, you know, the same way as in the United States, the association of white women with all these colored men and the drugs that they're consuming and what is it going to do to our societies? Next thing you know, in 1923, South Africa is lobbying the League of Nations to make cannabis a Schedule I drug, or what we call a Schedule I drug now. Why are people so scared of weed and black people? I have no idea. Maybe our panelists can help us figure that out a little bit. I'd like to welcome to the table Ms. Cassandra Frederick, Mr. Kojo Karam, and Mrs. Jessica Soto, if you would please. We are going to start the discussion with Ms. Cassandra Frederick. You saw Cassandra in the movie several times. She is the director of the New York State Office for the Drug Policy Alliance and is also instrumental in reducing the number of arrests related to cannabis and racial discrimination in the city of New York, which is no small feat. So, absolutely. Cassandra, maybe you could tell us a bit more about the history behind it, but also putting in perspective the legal or not legal changes that happened in Albany last week around cannabis legalization.
So good morning. Oh, good afternoon, everyone. You can see where my mind is. Like he said, I'm with Drug Policy Alliance. We're a national organization working to end the criminalization associated with drug possession and sales in the world. Mostly we focus on the U.S. and really starting to really articulate the role that U.S. policy has done to foreign countries in exporting our terrible drug laws. So I direct our New York work, and I think when we're having conversations around cannabis, I think it's important for us to really recognize the role that New York has played, which I think was very much highlighted in this film, the role that cannabis prohibition has played in New York based in our history. I think when we're having conversations about cannabis and the role of race in the United States, we know that this conversation actually isn't about cannabis. Right? This is about how do we create a substance? How do we use a substance as a way to criminalize certain communities? And this really goes to the major thesis of what the drug war is about, which is that our drug laws are not based on the pharmacology of the drug, but based on the face of the perceived dominant user population, which is a major thesis that Dr. Troy Duster put forward in his book, Legislation of Morality, which was published in 1970. And I often start my talks with that point because I think it's important to recognize that that thesis was laid out before Richard Nixon declared the war on drugs in 1971. So it's to disabuse people of the idea that everything that has happened has been a mistake or has been a coincidence, and recognizing that everything that has happened was the purpose of our drug laws. That the conversation isn't that our drug laws are broken or that the system is broken. The system is working exactly the way that it's supposed to. And our continued feigned surprise or idea that this was not supposed to happen is disrespectful to the communities that have been most impacted, that have been most criminalized. we know what drug policies can be, because we can look at things like the rhetoric around the current opioid overdose crisis in the United States, which is very much like, this is a health issue. This is not a criminal justice issue. We have to support communities. We have to have a gentler war on drugs. And what that recognizing and is a tacit admission is that the war on drugs that we currently have has been too brutal, too invasive, too destructive for the communities that it has already impacted. And so I think when we're having conversations about cannabis, it's important for us to recognize the role that cannabis has played. And oftentimes people think that cannabis is an issue or a drug that doesn't have great consequences. And I think what people consistently miss, and one of the conversations that we consistently center in the United States, is the role that cannabis arrests have had in this country and how they are one of the top arrests in this country. And so what does that mean is that this moment is about how do we have conversations about the thing that is most being used to criminalize us, and how do we disrupt that? Not only disrupt it, but unroot it. And how do we expand the idea of what is happening? What is cannabis used for? Oftentimes, people frequently talk about arrest, but they often miss the role that cannabis plays in other forms of our lives. So the things around employment, the drug testing that happens, the things around parole and probation, the way that cannabis drug testing gets people reincarcerated and recidivated, the fact that people are losing custody of their kids in child welfare, which continues the conversation of disrupting families, particularly families of color, where you have black and brown families that are losing custody of their kids in family court, yet you have white moms on the cover of high society fashion magazines talking about being stiletto stoners and how weed impacts their positively impacts their parenting, right? So you have all these parties about CBD lattes, and you have thousands of black and Latino moms in family courts in the Bronx and Brooklyn who are fighting for their families to be able to stay together. And so in this conversation that we are having nationally about the caging of families and the caging of young people, primarily of color, we have to recognize and connect the dots that the drug war does the same thing domestically. We are caging young people either through incarceration or through family separation with a lot of the same deleterious effects. In New York, we are fighting a campaign to regulate cannabis that is not based on the idea of whether we regulate cannabis or not, but based on the idea of how do we regulate cannabis? How do we have a conversation about removing cannabis as a way to criminalize communities and move it into a space where we can have conversations about how we reinvest? And also the very real conversation of, as people that are in this room around drug policy, right, talking about cannabis reform, recognizing that our work to end criminalization is creating space for another exploitative structure to disempower and exploit the same communities, and that is capitalism. And what does it mean for our movement to finally really tangle with capitalism in a way that is also a campaign? Because we've had those conversations, especially when it's come to the conversations around drug pricing and HIV/AIDS, and or you know the cost of naloxone, but we haven't fully figured out how to take that on. And I think cannabis forces our movement to figure out, what does it mean for capitalism to be the main engine that is coming into this space? Because we've talked about capitalism in the conversation about private prisons and incarceration and all the money they use to spend, but we have created space for people who are not invested in the humanity and dignity of people to come in and exploit our victories around drug policy reform. There are people that are in that space that are exploiting the space that we have created. This is one of the major theses of Michelle Alexander's book. When we end the drug war, what will come in its place? And we have to be very careful and accountable to what we see right now in cannabis reform. What are we creating the space for? And what is our accountability as responsible policymakers to what we have created the room for? In New York, the conversation and the fight that we are in is as I said, is less so about whether we legalize cannabis and more so how we legalize cannabis, but it's also about who do we prioritize in legalizing cannabis. And last week, we lost the conversation around regulating cannabis in New York, not on the merits of whether we should legalize cannabis, but who should cannabis regulation be based on? Should it be based on communities most impacted, or should it be based on abetting the fears of law enforcement? Should it be based on abetting the fears of whiteness? Because what we did have, what did show up in the opposition, were white elected officials saying that they were hearing pushback from white parents saying that they feared for their children if we legalized cannabis. And that until we allayed those fears, it was okay for us to continue the criminalization associated, the criminalization that is targeted in communities of color and poor people. That is what we were fighting against. The idea that whiteness, again, was centered in a movement that is so honestly, structurally, strategically, ethically supposed to be structured and centered on the communities most impacted, and to be very explicit, Black and brown New Yorkers. What is the takeaway of that? How do we have that conversation? We have a governor who is very clearly committed to the idea that the money cannot be controlled by communities, that he should be controlling it. What we are doing around marijuana legalization in New York is less about marijuana and more about socializing the idea that harm was done and that harm needs to be repaired, and there has to be a commitment to this never happening again, and that the money that is created must be reinvested in the communities that have been divested from, and that the economic capitalist actors that are in the space are not accountable to their shareholders, but are accountable to the communities that have had their blood shed. That is the conversation that we are socializing in this moment around this campaign, and recognizing that this campaign around regulating cannabis in New York, which was the marijuana arrest capital in this country, that this campaign is more than about a plan. It is about socializing the idea that drug war harms were done and that drug war harms need to be accounted for, that the communities need to be the first to be reinvested in, and that the people that are benefiting from our advocacy, that are now set up to exploit our same communities, are not accountable to their shareholders, but are accountable to the communities. That is the conversation. And if there's conversations happening in this country around cannabis reform that are not centering those things, then they're not talking about cannabis reform. They are trying to build a structure for a giveaway. And what they are giving away again and again is our community lives, humanity, and dignity.
Thank you very much for that, Cassandra. Our next speaker is Mr. Kojo Karam. Kojo is a lecturer and a writer. He lectures at the Birkbeck School of Law at the University of London. And he's also the editor of The War on Drugs and the Global Color Line that you can purchase right outside this room. Kojo, it's safe to say that you have both a global perspective and a British perspective. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that and how it relates to what we've seen in the ongoing discourse.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you to everyone from Open Society for inviting me over and facilitating this trip. When I got an invitation to come to New York at the time of Gay Pride for an evening on drugs, I got very excited, but turned out to be a lecturer. But that's still you know, really wonderful to be here and be able to, yeah, discuss this really crucial issue with yourselves. And so I do want to talk a little bit about the international perspective, but not to minimize that my own kind of entry into thinking about the relationship between drugs and race did actually begin in the US itself, in New Orleans and Louisiana, the kind of center point of the film we just watched. I came to New Orleans to work as to work for a capital defense firm in 2012, and that meant a lot of my work was up in, you know, Angola prison and the parish prisons around. And, you know, to go to Angola and to see, you know, a prison that is larger than the island of Manhattan, where we live right now, that is that it's called colloquially and kind of semi-officially Angola, based on the fact that it was a former slave plantation and most of the slaves came from Angola and sub-Saharan Africa, and that it's no surprise to go onto that prison and to see 12, 15 black and brown men tied together working the field with one white guard on horseback. You know, that's a real visceral explanation of Michel Alexander's thesis in The New Jim Crow, the idea of the drug war and mass incarceration as the latest cycle in a history of racial violence that brings in plantation slavery, Jim Crow, and now the war on drugs. You know, like in 2012, I walked in there, I thought I was in 1812. It's really quite a shocking scene. But then returning back to the UK and working for an organization called Release, which is kind of the UK's equivalent of the Drug Policy Alliance, I started to see that a lot of those issues that are identified in the United States are not simply contained within the United States. And why should they be? You know, if we think about the issues that we're discussing, we're talking about the relationship between drugs, race, and law. None of those are confined within a single jurisdiction. You know, drugs is a global commodity. Race is obviously a global system of social control. And even the laws that prohibit drugs aren't simply domestic. They're international. They're enshrined in international law in multiple UN treaties. And so in the UK, there is also a huge amount of disproportionality in terms of who's arrested and who's then convicted once they're arrested for drugs charges that's led to a situation that I think a lot of Americans would be surprised to hear this, but in the UK, as a proportion of the entire black population of the country, there's actually a higher proportion of them in prison in the UK than there is in the United States. So there's not a larger, in terms of the overall, UK doesn't have the same amount of black people as the United States does, but as a proportion of who is actually in the country, more of them are currently incarcerated than the proportion of African Americans who are incarcerated. And further research, I would see colleagues who work in South Africa has been mentioned, Brazil, Colombia, all of these areas discussing the racial and ethnic division that is facilitated by the prohibition of drugs. And I kind of put those all together in the editor collection that's outside. And I think there is also a global asymmetry as well that we need to think about when we think about the war on drugs. I guess a simple way to try and describe it is that the war on drugs internationally is what people call supply side focused, which means that the heavy enforcement is visited upon the areas that are supposed to produce, grow, and supply these drugs and the communities that are associated, you know, within the United States and within the West for supplying those drugs. It's not focused in terms of the demand, because if it was whoever likes taking drugs, there'd be a lot more people being punished for the drug use than there currently is. It's based on where it's produced and who is seen as the supplier of these substances. And so when we think about the devastation that the 100-year war on drugs has visited, we need to look at areas like Cali, Colombia, you know, where Plan Colombia led to huge amounts of deforestation, crop eradication, you know, aerial fumigation policies, populations being displaced. We need to think about areas like Juarez, Mexico, you know, where the actual rate of civilian murder was higher than places like Afghanistan in the start of the 21st century. You know, these are areas that have really been devastated by the war on drugs. And when we think about the question of reparations, which has to come when we talk about the transition of the end of the war on drugs, of repairing the harm that's been done, we need to think about that at an international level as well, I think. Mm-hmm. We need to think about how do we repair, you know, the Amerindian and Afro-Colombian communities in places like Cali, Colombia, that have been driven off their land due to an association with coca leaf farming. We need to think about, you know, how do we invest in those global communities and ensure that the transition of these substances into legal commodities doesn't simply facilitate more Western neoliberal exploitation of these communities. Because it's not like you know, kind of Western capitalism requires commodities to be illegal for them to exploit and devastate communities in the global South. A lot, you know, think about oil, think about gold, and a lot of these drugs that were encountered at the same time of other substances that are now legal commodities that have been normalized in our culture, you know. The thing which is really interesting, I think, historically, when we talk about the war on drugs, is how recent it often is. You know, over 100 years ago, the European empires, Britain, Holland, France, had hugely profitable international drug trades. The British even fought a war with the Qing dynasty in China in order to protect their lucrative opium trade.
That's right.
And, you know, so alongside the trade in coffee, in sugar, was also the trade in opium and in coca leaf. And it's really with the entrance of the United States into the international arena and the transition from the kind of formal colonial relations into a more universal idea of humanity that you start to see drug prohibition acting as a division between peoples of the world once those kind of formal divisions were started to disintegrate. And so I think that's a crucial thing to try and hold on to when we try and understand why the war on drugs emerged over the 21st century. It's no surprise that in places where there was that proximity between the races, where there was that proximity between these supposedly categorized divisions between human beings, that substances that are supposed to facilitate the dropping of white people into the category of savages or supposed to make savage populations come above their station, that starts to be criminalized, that starts to be feared in a way that it wasn't over the 17th and 18th centuries. And so as we move into the 21st century, I think that we really want to think about, as that system of drug prohibition comes to a close, how are we going to stop a new system of global exploitation replacing it? How are we going to repair those harms that are occurring, not just to communities of color in the United States, but to communities in the global South that have really carried heavy, heavy burdens for trying to protect European and American whiteness from the fear of a drug that could make them savage. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kojo. Our last speaker is Ms. Jessica Soto, who is a filmmaker and an activist from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, and the co-founder of Movimentos, which is a collective working in the favelas to reduce the harms of the war on drugs and reform drug policy. Jessica, as a filmmaker and an artist, how do you see the role of the arts in drug policy reform? And given where you live and work, what can you tell us about the recent policy changes of the newly elected Brazilian president?
Can you repeat the end?
What she could tell us about the new reality given that Jair Bolsonaro is now president of Brazil.
Bom, boa noite a todas e todos. Primeiro, pedir desculpa por não falar inglês, mas isso também faz parte de processo político, né?
Good evening, everybody. I'm sorry I don't speak English, but this is a part also of a political agenda.
Bom, levando em consideração o meu trabalho como filmmaker e toda a atuação política, principalmente na área de direitos humanos, eu, junto com os meus amigos do coletivo Movimentos, que somos jovens de várias favelas e periferias do Rio de Janeiro.
Taking in account me, myself, and all of my colleagues that are also from the favelas and activists,
trabalhamos principalmente a questão principalmente direitos humanos, mas principalmente o recorte racial a quem a guerra às drogas está combatendo e esse controle social por trás dela.
We work focus on the war on drugs and especially the stigmatizing of people of color.
Eu sou do complexo de favelas do Alemão. O complexo de favelas do Alemão ele tem hoje em torno de 160 mil pessoas, uma estimativa de 160 mil pessoas, que quer dizer que ele é maior que o bairro do Harlem aqui em Nova York, por exemplo.
I was born in the favela, complexo do Alemão. This is a complex of 14 favelas that's bigger than the borough of Harlem here in New York.
Apesar da guerra às drogas ter ganhado muita força na década de 70 com o discurso do Nixon, o Brasil ele traz enfrentamento às drogas e principalmente às pessoas, né, esse controle social, muito anterior a isso. Na década de 1830, o Brasil ele já proibia alguns elementos, como a maconha, que era usada principalmente pela população negra, em ritos religiosos. Também, ainda na década de 1830, proibiu o candomblé, a capoeira, todos os elementos da cultura afro-brasileira.
Although the war on drugs is increased around the declaration, when Nixon did the declaration in the 70s, the war on drugs started much way before that. The first legislation in Brazil was a date from 1831, and this has the aim to criminalize people of color, and was not only related to war, to drugs, but also to capoeira, which is a dance, and ceremonies of candomblé.
Hoje eu estou ocupando um espaço, tanto aqui, mas principalmente no Brasil. O que o movimento vem fazendo é ocupar espaços onde a favela não tinha espaço, não tinha voz para falar, ocupando espaços onde a gente sempre foi segregado. Então, o nosso principal objetivo é, primeiro de tudo, pegar informações que nunca chegaram até a favela e devolver para as favelas e periferias de uma forma fácil para que as pessoas compreendam e possam elas mesmas poderem falar o que elas precisam, o que é melhor para si, porque... Sorry.
Today I have a space to talk, but for a long time, and I feel privileged to have this space. But our focus is to get as much information as we can and give back this information and research to the people of favelas for them to have a better life, a better discernment.
Hoje a maconha ela é aceita em muitos espaços. Hoje a gente fala mais abertamente sobre uso recreativo, sobre uso medicinal, mas nas favelas e periferias do Brasil a gente tem um discurso que é ainda mais urgente. A gente precisa se manter vivo para conseguir fazer o uso da maconha, seja ele recreativo, seja ele no âmbito medicinal, porque o que acontece no Brasil é um genocídio de uma população jovem, negra e periférica.
So today we talk much more about marijuana as a medical medicine or a recreation. But what we need to talk more is in Brazil is about the genocide that's being happening in Brazil around the marijuana and in the favelas that is. Related, they always try to combine the idea of marijuana users and black people of color and brown people and young people.
Somente esse ano, até a data de hoje, a polícia no Rio de Janeiro matou 7 pessoas por dia.
Until this year, until this date, the average number of people that was killed by police is in Rio de Janeiro is 7 a day.
E a gente vê cada vez mais um movimento de descrença na nossa pesquisa, nos índices, nos dados. E é uma das nossas grandes perdas. A gente tem um governo hoje que é um governo autoritário, de extrema-direita, fascista, e que se elegeu com base em notícias falsas, principalmente no âmbito das drogas.
We see our sources very discriminated now, and they people don't believe on our agenda. anymore because we have a president now, fascist, that he was elected based in false researches and I'm sorry. false researches against a war on drugs.
É, assim como aqui nos Estados Unidos, o Brasil ele também sofre com encarceramento em massa. É, mas, para além do encarceramento em massa, a gente está dando conta desse genocídio que é o nosso principal bloco hoje, que a gente... Além do encarceramento em massa, a gente está enfrentando o genocídio da nossa população, que é a nossa principal barreira, é a principal coisa que a gente está combatendo hoje. Enfim, o filme ele fala muito sobre a nossa população, a gente fala muito sobre os nossos, sobre a nossa história, sobre todo esse enfrentamento, mas a gente tem que levar em consideração que tem muitas vidas ainda sendo tiradas todos os dias, e que isso acontece de várias formas, seja no encarceramento, seja com uma bala, que hoje eles chamam de perdida, mas ela tem um endereço certo, que são as favelas e periferias.
So, we have, besides the problem of incarceration, like you have here in the United States, we have also the problem of genocide. We have this problem every day is part of life, everyday life, and not only the snipers and police shooting directly to the favelas, but also the what they call lost bullet. That's was a bullet that what they say is not intended to us, but we know that it is.
É isso, obrigada. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Jessica. We have the floor for another 10 minutes for questions from the audience. I suggest we take maybe two or three questions first and then go for another round. Who's going first? Yes. If you could just please tell us your name.
Sure. Bruce Trigg in New York City. Thank you so much. Great discussion. The state of Illinois became the first state through legislation, through their legislature, to legalize. But I haven't heard how they addressed the issues of reparations and fairness to the communities that have been most affected. Because that seemed to be what blocked New Jersey and New York. So I assume you can please enlighten us on that.
Yeah, so.
Just a second, we can say a couple more questions. Sheila, you want to ask something? There was somebody else here?
Yes. I don't know how she's going to, or it's going to be answered. But
so it relates to his question. Okay. Yes. No, she has roughly the same question, and she wants to see how Cassandra is going to respond. Is there anybody else with another question from one of the panelists? No? All right, Cassandra, the floor is yours.
So you're right. Illinois did pass legalization through the legislature, and they actually signed it today. And we actually had some of the legislators come out to New York last week to talk to us about some of the work that they've done. And their initiative, all 500 pages of it, they really got into the details around the regulation, and they did include like 20% of their funding to go to some sort of community reinvestment. I was working on the New York campaign, so they did include expungement. They did include some kind of making sure that the industry was as diverse. I've heard different opinions of what if what they put in was strong enough to really make sure that the industry was diverse. And we know that they did put 20% of their money to go towards some sort of reinvestment in communities. And so we're still digging deeply into what their proposal was, because one of the things with them is that they put in a structure that was kind of like a skeleton, and then they published the bill, and then they passed it. So it was one of those things where they were very strategic behind the scenes to work everything through. Their governor was working with them, so there was never a doubt that the governor was working to get the votes and also working to make sure that it passed, and he signed it today, which is a very different scenario than where we are here in New York.
Hi, I'm Marion. I wanted to ask the gentleman about Angola. Were the men that are incarcerated for drug-related crimes or other nature crimes? Because that makes a huge difference. I've been to Africa a number of times, and there's a harsher notion of punishment than perhaps need be and than is current in the United States. But I wanted to know the nature of the crimes that put people in such circumstances. Thank you.
Just before Kojo speaks, the name might be a bit confusing because he was referring to Angola prison in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. That is named because a lot of the slaves were imported from Angola to that region. So it's not a comment on African detention.
But maybe you could tell us more about Angola.
That's correct. Yes, I was referring to Angola prison in Louisiana. In relationship to were they there for drug offenses, a lot of them, as that film showed, were there because of multiple offenses, and multiple offenses can escalate in the state of Louisiana. Louisiana is the highest incarcerating state in the United States, which is also the highest incarcerated country in the world. And, you know, the way a lot of that is produced is by the use of multiple convictions leading to the kind of life imprisonment that would end up in a state penitentiary like Louisiana. I also spent a lot, like Angola, I also spent a lot of time in a lot of the parish prisons. In relationship to the impact of the war on drugs on sub-Saharan Africa, if that's also something you're interested in, you might want to look at a lot of the consequences of the emergence of West Africa, particularly as a significant transit route mm-hmm. for drugs from Latin America into the European market. And so countries like Guinea-Bissau particularly have been impacted by the rise of the illegal drugs trade, and also the rise of the funding of the attempt to have a counter-narcotics program. So similar to what happened in Latin America, you know, everyone's seen Narcos, haven't they? Yeah, you know, and Netflix, not that idea of the rising of a drugs trade being matched by investment disproportionately funded often by the United States of America in counter-narcotics programs under the direction of the DEA that lead to more weaponry for local law enforcement, harsher prison sentences, and lead to that escalating violence. And so that's happened in places like Nigeria, places like Ghana, where my family's from, but particularly in countries like Guinea-Bissau. So the war on drugs has had a massive impact even on sub-Saharan African communities as well.
Thank you for that, Kojo.
Yes.
Hi. Ooh. Thank you for all of that, what you started explaining. I was thinking, I've been doing work in New York for the last 10 years in immigrant services and then domestic violence, and seeing how those two worlds have been very siloed at times, and that the DV service system is very carceral. Mm-hmm. So I was going to ask if any of you, have you found, because the underlying aspects of fixation on incarceration as a solution is in everything we've seen and heard. Have you found success trying to integrate in anti-carceral prison reform mm-hmm. movements or not? And sort of what has that been like as you try to advance people against a war on drugs? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So I think your point is exactly right. I think one of the things that we are trying to better articulate and actually focus more on is what is an alternative system to people that need care. So one of the biggest treatment providers in this country is the correctional facility. So as people have conversations about no new jails, closing jails, we also have to have the conversation about where do people go if they need help. And the conversation about there is also the conversation where people are like jails, but treatment, but don't specify the fact that we don't want treatment to be coercive, right? And that the treatment that is most effective is one that's voluntarily based, right? And so the conversation that we're having around the role of carceral politics, and the drug war is one that we actually have to navigate. So as we see conversations around the drug war and policing in particular, people are having the conversation of, should we be investing in diversion programs? And there are some people in the space that's like, actually, we should not be investing in diversion programs, because law enforcement and police officers in particular should be nowhere near people who use drugs. And we should be having conversations about who are alternative actors that we think have the capacity to acknowledge the full humanity and dignity of people who are struggling. And so I think there is a conversation, because I think our movement is limited and does a disservice to the kind of work and the kind of world we want to see when we concede the idea that carceral politics is essential for us to actually deal with problematic drug use. And so for us to have conversations, we need to, for us to really move to a place where we are moving away from punishment, we need to have the conversation about what are active alternatives. And part of the reason why that is so important is because we will have a situation where we say, you know, social workers, not police officers, should be dealing with drugs. And then you have social workers acting as carceral actors, right? You have social workers taking on a law enforcement conversation. And we see this especially in DV situations, right? Where you have actors that are not law enforcement acting in a punitive or coercive way when they're trying to disrupt relationships that can be problematic. And that what that also does is disempower and destabilize autonomy of the people that are getting services. And one of the things that is a pillar of drug policy reform and should remain a pillar is maintaining the autonomy of the person that we are engaging with. And I think it's very hard for us to maintain autonomy when we're using law enforcement as an actor to navigate that autonomy. And so I think our conversations, not just about what is the role of drug war policing in our space, right? Like actually having the conversation about not what is the role of law enforcement, but is there a role for law enforcement? And should there be a role for law enforcement? These are very difficult conversations. If we are saying we want to decriminalize all drug possession, right? We're moving with a decrim model, and some people are moving towards a regulation model, then how do we have the conversation about incarceration? The other thing is, if we are so focused on a carceral way of politics that is limited to the criminal legal system and the detainment of people, we miss the carceral politics that affect people in housing, in child welfare, in immigration. And like, there are so many other systems that the drug war is invested in. And the drug war is so pervasive. And one of the best things that the drug war is successful at is people not being able to identify that the drug war is at play when they're dealing with different systems that they're encountering. And so having the conversation about, what does it mean that people have to pee in a cup to get access to food stamps? What does it mean for the fact that people can be out of incarceration for years beyond community supervision, parole, or probation, and then recidivate because they smoked weed? Like, why are we sending people back in to a system that we know is problematic? And so I think there is this conversation. I don't want to put us in this conversation around an either or, around like abolition or not. But if we are talking about ending prohibition, are we talking about abolition? And if we are talking about abolition, or we're not talking about abolition, there has to be a clear politic about that. And I don't think it's an either or. I think it's both and. And I think there's a spectrum, and I think more people have to be working at multiple intersections so that we build out that muscle and the capacity and the theory of change of how we get to a place that builds a broader vision of justice.
Thank you, Cassandra. We have time for one more question. Anybody? No? Yes, in the front. Okay.
Hi, thank you for everyone today. It's really great. In September of 2008, I applied to get a medical marijuana card in the state of New York. Mm-hmm. There were multiple reasons for it. One being I was going to be getting a job at a hospital within the city, and they were going to make me take a test, and I was concerned that I wasn't going to pass because I used marijuana for my pain. And on top of that, I was like, let me check this out. Let me see how this process goes. I was floored at what I went through to get the medical marijuana card. I couldn't believe that not only did it cost me over $1,000, to get a medical marijuana card, knowing that a doctor signed off on it and so on and so forth. And I looked at that and I said to myself, if this is costing me $1,000 and I'm a student and I'm an, you know, older white person, what does this mean for everybody else? So on the very bare bones of where we have established ourselves right now, as far as like where we are at in New York State, and it's only, to my knowledge, for medical purposes only that you can get a license. I don't know where one goes from that point. Like, where do we, because that's not even right. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And so to me, I said, we need to go back to the drawing board. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about that? Since that seems, it's a huge racket. I mean, MedMen, this, I won't even go in there because it's like going into like, you feel like you're a criminal. I mean, it's like ridiculous the way they set it up in the city. And I won't even use the card. And considering not even renewing it because of not only the cost, but of how ridiculous they've set it up. So if you could just shed a little new information. Yeah.
So in 2014, New York passed medical marijuana. I think this is one of the biggest lessons learned about responsible policymaking. We were in a situation where we worked to pass the bill, and at the last minute, Governor Cuomo redid the bill. And it wasn't patient access. It was based on the idea of how do we prevent diversion. So it was never a medical program. It was essentially his version of doing a public safety program around medical cannabis. It, you know, oftentimes people talk about that campaign and talk about how moving it was because we had young kids with epilepsy, white moms and grandmas with cancer who were coming up to the Capitol. Oftentimes what people forget and mistake is that we also had people who had HIV/AIDS there that were homeless, that were formerly incarcerated, that had been diagnosed with HIV/AIDS. And groups like Vocal New York and Housing Works and different partners from the syringe exchanges around New York City that were also working with us. And none of them can afford the program currently. And I think one of the things that I said before around how we move to adult use and building a program that is accountable is the fact that the way that the medical program was built is not accountable to the people it was supposed to serve. It was accountable to the interests and to the fears of whiteness. And it was accountable to allay the concerns of law enforcement. And the patients were never centered. And so how do we build a medical program that is actually accountable to patients and accessible to patients? And so one of the things that we've done in the work around creating a regulatory market for adult use is recognizing that we actually do have to redo the medical program and that we actually have to put forward a conversation based on the Berkeley model where, you know, insurance, currently federally, insurance is not going to pay for medical cannabis. And that means that people that are have the least access to healthcare, have the least access to resources, are never going to be able to use medical grade cannabis to deal and manage with their pain. And one of the things that I've been saying is that if you're going to come here and make money on medical cannabis, 2% of your stock has to go to Medicaid patients, has to go to local syringe exchanges, needs to go to community health clinics, and have the conversation that actually, again, you are not accountable to your shareholders. You are accountable to our community. And the only reason you are in this space is because these communities made it so. And so therefore, they should not get low cost. They should get free medical cannabis, right? Like, we just need to get to the conversation that we don't actually need to concede, because right now the biggest thing that's in the forefront is how do we, certain people are getting rich and some people are not getting rich. The rich people that are in the space in New York, some are making money, most of them are not making money because the current program is super limited. And so for us, when we moved to work on adult use because we realized that the medical program was just not viable, we kind of walked away from that advocacy to really build out adult use. And I think what we've come back to is that if we're going to do adult use, we need to fix medical. And so that has been some of the work that we've been doing. It's super expensive to get access to medical cannabis. And the doctors that are working in the communities most impacted are the same doctors that don't prescribe opioids to people of color, therefore won't prescribe medical cannabis to people of color. And so there is a huge necessity for there to be some sort of education in the healthcare space, but also a reckoning in the New York legislature that the way that they built this was not impactful. And so to your point, part of the work that we're doing around the regulation of adult use is also taking on the medical cannabis program and redoing it and getting it to be more accessible and more patient-centered. So getting rid of the qualifying conditions, incentivizing physicians for using medical cannabis, increasing geographic diversity, because there's like one place in Brooklyn, one place in Queens. That doesn't make sense. But also making sure that we don't give the bigger players that you named the ability to basically spread out so that when adult use comes, they're already lying in wait to cannibalize the space. And so how do we also make sure that other people that are not fully vested venture capitalists can also be providers in the medical cannabis space? Because the fact of the matter is that everyone owes everything on the medical cannabis space to HIV and gay activists that really push this space into a place and really about making sure that we continue that history. And so to your question, that was one of the campaigns that we won, but we lost. Does that make sense? Like, you can win a campaign, but lose. And so, what does it mean for organizations like Drug Policy Alliance that have invested in these kinds of campaigns to remain committed to the implementation and to the dignity and integrity of the work that we think is so important? Because we did not create a medical marijuana, well, we didn't create it, but we didn't fight for a medical cannabis program that didn't impact the people that need it the most. Because the fact of the matter is, a lot of the people that have access to medical cannabis right now always had access to cannabis. They didn't really need a medical cannabis program. And so why we created a medical cannabis program was so that people that had least access to healthcare were able to access alternative models so that they could be able to be in that space. And one of my favorite signs from our activists in our coalition is, you can't spell healthcare without THC.
And on that note, thank you to our panelists. Thank you for Kojo for making the trip from the UK. Thank you, Jessica, for making the trip from Brazil. Thank you all for participating. And yes, let's take these words to heart and remember that this is not just a fight for activists, but for all of us. Thank you.